from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, on the brink of a government default, Senate leaders have reportedly reached a deal, a short-term agreement to open the government and raise the debt ceiling. We'll get the details on the deal, which is expected to go to the House first for a vote, and we'll also discuss the implications for the economy and financial markets, and we'll discuss next steps. Join us for Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Senate leaders have reportedly reached a deal to reopen the government. And under the draft agreement, the government would be funded through the 15th of January and the debt limit raised through February 7th. It also contains a provision requiring income verification for people receiving Obamacare subsidies. And in this hour, we want to look at the details of this very tentative proposed deal and find out what might happen next. And the deal is about to be announced apparently on the floor, so it is imminent. Joining us, Bruce Kane, veteran political analyst, professor of political science at Stanford, and now director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West. And Bruce, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. We also say good morning to Jim Wilcox, who is in the nation's capital. He's professor in the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Jim Wilcox, glad to have you aboard. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we're going to also be joined later on by Lisa Mascaro, who is a congressional correspondent for the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times and who is on Capitol Hill. Bruce Kane, let me begin with you. It seems like they've got a deal here. Is this going to fly? I mean, it has to go to the House first, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, there's still procedural problems here. If it doesn't go to the House first, then you run into the possibility that Cruz and some of his allies might use delay tactics, and if they do that, then you run into the question of whether the government will truly have some cash shortages and whether the ratings agencies and the market will continue to show signs of panic. So, yes, it would be a problem if the House doesn't go first, and they have indicated they're not sure whether they're going to go first.
Let's talk about that momentarily, but first tell us what's in this bill. I mean, we have a pretty good draft of idea of what's in the draft, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, we've moved. It's been a moving target over the last week or two. We've gone down from repeal. I mean, the original linkage was to the Obamacare bill, and originally the Republicans wanted repeal, and then they went down to delaying different parts of it or the whole thing, and then it was specific taxes on medical devices, and now it looks like all they're going to get out of this is a provision of income verification for people that are getting the government subsidy, which is, of course, a massive retreat from their initial position, but at least something that gives them some face-saving room. It leaves the sequestration in effect, which means that both parties are unhappy with this, possibly the Democrats more than the Republicans, although, as we know, a lot of Republicans, even those in California, are very concerned about the defense cuts. But it puts into place a sort of budget negotiation framework for the next few months to try to iron these things out. Of course, it's hard to have a lot of faith that that's going to work since we've had these frameworks before. But at any rate, that's where we are. There still was some discussion this morning, and I don't know how it got resolved, over what kind of flexibility there would be for agencies under sequestration, with the administration saying, let's not give them a lot of flexibility because we want it to hurt enough so that people have an incentive to negotiate. And the Republicans obviously have been continually pushing for some sort of flexibility or picking and choosing the parts of the government they want to remain open. So I'm not sure how that got resolved this morning. Perhaps we'll hear later.
And again, this would be funded through the 15th of January, and the debt limit would be raised through the 7th of February. But let's just talk about, you mentioned procedure. This would be moving faster, presumably, through the House. But can't any senator still hold up the bill in the Senate past the Thursday deadline? I mean, it's a faster path toward passage in the House, but theoretically, I think a senator can still hold it up.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that there's going to be a lot of focus on Mr. Cruz.
And Mike just, Lee.
Yeah, I mean, and his allies, I should say. I'm sorry. But the point is that there's a lot of pressure inside the Republican Party on the Senate Tea Party allies to hold off on this, that there's no good that's going to come out of it, that at this point they're not going to get any additional concessions, and that they should not delay things. I don't know, it's quite possible that the government could survive the 30 hours or so that they have, that they could delay things, but nobody really wants to test that.
And what about the Hassert rule as far as the Republicans that says essentially the House Speaker should not try to pass a bill that doesn't have the support of the majority of the majority? That would be 117 Republicans to support this bill.
Yes. Well, that, of course, has been the major motivation, I think, for Boehner's trying to figure out how to get a coalition together. But it's not the first time that Mr. Boehner has allowed the Senate to take the lead, and then he's basically done an open vote in the House. In the past, you know, for example, with the tax cuts, he was able to get maybe 80 allies. This time we're talking about possibly just struggling to make the 24 or so that he needs. So that's still an open question whether he can get those votes. But just in the last couple of days, it seems like more Republicans who weren't coming forward before were saying now that they really feel it's time for moving forward. So I think the expectations are that this will get just enough votes, and it is a violation of the Hastert rule, but, you know, he's done it before. It has implications for whether he'll stay as Speaker. You know, I think a lot of people think that he may not survive another Congress in this position, given what's happened to him.
Bruce Kane, again, professor of political science at Stanford. Jim Wilcox is professor in the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And Jim Wilcox, how's this affect? I mean, the market is suddenly surging. The Dow was down yesterday, so there is anticipation that this will be a deal to be worked out. But the Fitch agency yesterday said credit rating is at stake. I mean, there's I want to make sure I pronounce that right. Fitch. There's a lot at stake here economically.
Yes, there is indeed, and in part, we think there's a lot at stake that we're not really quite sure about. If, in fact, there were really a default on U.S. Treasury issues, bills, notes, and bonds, the things that are held by our money market funds that are used by banks everywhere and serve as a part of the foundation of the financial system, I think at this point we're not exactly sure where all the trouble would ripple through. Much like we weren't sure quite what would happen when Lehman Brothers went under back in the fall of 2008.
Well, just here locally, Lawrence Livermore is laying off 5,500 employees today, and they're certainly furloughing, I should say, not laying off, sending home without their paychecks, actually. And the hurt can continue as this drags on. I mean, a lot more misery in store if it does continue to drag on, no?
Yes, well, of course, the government shutdown and the debt ceiling are not necessarily linked, but they have become in the political process. If, in fact, we do not raise the debt ceiling, but it looks like we will, but if we didn't, then all of a sudden we would instantly be in a balanced budget position from then onward, because the only checks the government could write, because it couldn't borrow anymore, would be checks that could be covered by the cash that came in just before that. So that would put a real restraint on outlays by the Treasury, far more severe than what we're now living with under the sequestration.
Well, some of the Tea Party people, Representative Steve King, for example, says he's holding out for a balanced budget and for cuts in entitlements. I'm just wondering about the rhetoric that you're hearing from people like Cruz and Mike Lee and Steve King. They're saying, you know, this is just a date. It really doesn't mean anything.
Well, I think it actually can mean quite a lot. Of course, there is a difference between the government defaulting, if we want to use that word, on some of its non-bond, non-borrowing obligations. That is, suppose it's not able to send out Social Security checks on time. One might say that they've sort of defaulted on that obligation. even that is, and that usually we think would involve a delay and not a very long one. Defaulting on bonds is in some ways even more serious and something even more to be avoided, because a technical bond default would then make it very difficult to convince the rest of the world that we wouldn't do it again, and perhaps to a much larger extent. And so all of a sudden you'd be casting a completely unnecessary cloud of uncertainty over what has been rock solid, which is the full faith and credit of the United States.
And the global effect of this economically?
Well, it depends on how big the effect would be domestically first. I think the global effects mostly would come about if it affected the U.S. economy and the U.S. financial system. If the effects on the U.S. weren't large, I wouldn't expect them to be to have very large ripples abroad. But we're not altogether sure how large the effects might be. When you're starting to poke holes in the plumbing of the financial system, a lot of things can go wrong. And as we saw following the Lehman event 5 years ago, it turns out that some of these financial instruments are providing support and collateral and the foundation of transactions in very, very many places. And weakening even a little bit of that foundation can cause really painful disruptions.
Jim Wilcox, again with us from D.C., is professor in the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Also with us from the nation's capital is Lisa Mascaro, who is congressional correspondent with the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times. And Lisa, welcome. Good to have you here on Forum.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you and glad to get an update from you. I mean, at this point, the deal is pretty imminent, no?
Yeah, you know, they're just so close. They left here last night. The Senate leader is very close with the quote and the word we got from our sources here, very close on the deal. And, of course, the Senate just gaveled open, and everyone's sort of on pins and needles expecting an announcement here shortly, but it has not yet come. Of course, House Republican leaders were meeting this morning, too, behind closed doors. You know, I think everyone sort of wants to sort of make this work at this point. They realize they're in the final hour, but these things always take time. Looks like we might have some movement here, so if I'll try not to have to hang up, but we'll see how it goes here.
Well, I'm anxious to get your take on a couple of things. I mean, Mitch McConnell was pushing pretty hard to include language to give federal agencies more flexibility to implement the sequester, and that was something Harry Reid was objecting to. So where does that stand? Do you know?
Yeah, that is a good question, and I don't think I'm not 100% sure that was part of the deal. I'm so sorry. I am going to have to jump and do this, but for the most part, the deal will, as they're framing it, would.
Well, I think she's jumped. how do you think that's going to play out, Bruce Kane?
Which part?
The idea of, like I say, McConnell pushing hard to have federal agencies have more flexibility in implementing the sequester and Reid objecting to it. That was certainly true this morning, even.
Right. No, I think it's a very important question, and that's why, you know, you can't think that today is going to go very smoothly because, you know, this whole dispute has been partly about the issues and partly about who has leverage and power, and not just at the moment, but playing it out into the future. So this is a debate not about this particular moment, but about where the leverage points will be in January and February when we go through this yet again.
Well, a new round of sequester cuts will be
exactly
enacted in January, and they're mostly going to hit the defense side of spending, aren't they?
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, what you can see the Democratic point of view. Well, okay, what do the Republicans, or at least a faction of the Republicans, care about the most? Well, they care the most about defense cuts. They care the least about many domestic programs. So if you have flexibility to move the money around and take care of defense, but just drastically cut, you know, domestic services, then, of course, the Republicans have the upper hand. So, again, there's always this layer. You're not just playing for the moment. You're playing for where you're going to be in a couple months. And that, I think, is what the issue is here. So I don't think the Democrats are going to are going to cave, or at least substantially cave, on that issue. I think they realize that if they do that, then and things get shifted around, they're going to be in a very weak position come January and February.
Talk about caving. There was an article in this morning's New York Times essentially that said that President Obama has not caved in on these concessions. He put up a red line and has maintained that red line. I suspect actually that's fairly accurate, of at least the way things have unfolded, isn't it?
Yes, and I think this was an element of the whole dynamic of negotiation, was that I think the Republicans believe that Obama is weak, that he's made concessions in the past, that he's left things on the table. And, of course, there are people inside the Democratic Party who believe the same thing. So another layer of meaning on this whole negotiation that we've been going through is about Obama's credibility when he says this is a red line, we're not going to go anywhere. Does he hold to it? I mean, and this spills over into lots of things, you know, in terms of his international negotiation, et cetera. So I think he realized that this was a really important point of credibility, that it wasn't just about this particular issue, but if they were going to believe him when he said this was a red line and that there was no negotiation, they have to believe him. Otherwise, they will continually push with future negotiations.
Let me at this juncture invite those of you listening to join the conversation here. We're talking about really an ongoing draft of a bill which may indeed bring something forward. And it's in all likelihood, as I said, it looks like the Senate has made a deal here, but there may be problems with the House, and there may be problems actually with the Senate as well in terms of some of those like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee who have been in opposition. But what this deal means, if it goes through, is that at least the partial shutdown will end and there will be some movement forward as far as the debt ceiling. Let's hear from you. In fact, I want to give you the telephone number so you can join us, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and we do want to hear from you. So, again, feel free to contribute to the conversation here. In fact, Harry Reid has officially now announced the deal. So you may want to join in, and please do at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments, reactions you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us, our Twitter handle @KQED Forum. Talking with Bruce Kane, who is professor of political science at Stanford, and Jim Wilcox, professor in the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, and we'll bring you into the conversation here forthwith. I wanted to, though, go back to Jim Wilcox for a moment, and Professor Wilcox, in this whole deal, we don't know actually a lot of the details yet, and certainly there are devilish details to be sure. But the medical device tax has been a great concern to businesses. And can you maybe explain why that has been such an important part of this?
Well, I think, of course, it was put in part to help provide some of the funding for Obamacare. And I think there were a couple aspects that people were worried about. But primarily, I think they were worried that this was going to be the nose under the camel's tent. And once you had established this particular tax, perhaps starting at a very low rate, that it was only going to go one way, and that's up. And I think there was also some fear that it might spread to other aspects of the medical system. That is, it starts out being a low tax just on equipment, but then it might not only have a higher rate on that base, but it also might spread to other aspects. And I think it was sort of the prospect of higher taxes overall that worried many in that industry.
What about also, I'd like to get your take on this, Jim Wilcox, how much of a concession do you think it is that they have this income verification on the Affordable Care Act? Is this just face-saving for the Republicans, or is this a minor concession or a big deal as you see it?
I don't think it's a very big deal, to the extent that people are reasonably asked to provide income verification. It might even be good public policy. But so I think it tends to be almost entirely face-saving and not to have a very large impact for the country as a whole.
Well, let me bring in your calls, and we'll begin, Mike, with you. Good morning. You're on the air, Mike. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I couldn't before, but I can now. Please join us.
Okay. Good morning. I just wondered if the Heritage Foundation has weighed in yet on this latest proposal from the Senate, And is there any indication of how they will tack on this particular one? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. It's a good one. Bruce Kane?
Yeah, it is a good one because that's what killed the deal last night at 5 o'clock. And that's really kind of extraordinary when you think about it, that an outside group could have such influence over the Republican caucus. And that's just a part of the larger picture of the growth of these independent groups, and their funding and their role in the nomination process.
Well, forgive me, Bruce, but Rush Limbaugh has a good deal of suasion, too, with the Republicans.
No, that's true. I mean,
as far as outside sources, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's right. You can take a line of evolution in the way outside voices are shaping congressional attitudes, and you can start with talk radio. I think that's right. But it's received a big push forward with the increase in independent expenditure and the Heritage Foundation, of course, taking Jim DeMint in, transformed itself from kind of the normal think tank into more of a pressure group and an interest group. So I don't know whether they weighed in on this. My guess is that they're not happy about it. That's probably why we're going to see a very small number of, if we get a successful vote out of the House, it will not have 80 or 90, I don't think, the way previous open votes have had. I think it is the outside pressure that will probably hold down that number.
Let me get another call on. Bob, that's you. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. My question is, I've heard this question come up before, but I haven't received a satisfactory response. And my comment is, I thought I lived in a democracy, but I come to find out that both on the immigration reform and now on this silly thing that's happening, one man is more powerful than the president. I had no chance to vote for or against John Boehner, but I come to find out that he controls everything. Why is that? What can we do about that? And let's change it for the future so that this can't happen again. This doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make any sense that this one man is more powerful than the President of the United States.
Well, John Boehner may control everything, but John Boehner seems to be controlled by about 20 Tea Party representatives. Yeah, Bruce Kane, to you.
Well, you said it exactly. I mean, if only Boehner controlled anything, we would be in better shape. But the point that the caller's making is a valid one. And what this has done, and I mean by this the last 2 years of fighting over the budget and over debt, what it's done is it's point out that the real weakness of the American political system when there's a real even division and split in the country on how to proceed. There's a reason why the American system hasn't been adopted widely by other countries, that most countries use a parliamentary system which fuses the executive and legislative branch, avoids all this divided government stuff that we suffer through. And the real problem you have is that the House is controlled by Republicans. They have to give consent to budgetary bills. The leader of the majority faction needs to have a majority of the people in his party supporting him, or he won't be leader. So, yes, in some sense, it is Boehner's fault because he's prioritizing his own career over what many people believe is an economic problem. But it's also a structural problem that divided government is a very hard form of government in order to govern consistently when there's divisions in society.
Right, we are going to a break, but when we come back, we'll take more of your calls and emails, and we'll ask Jim Wilcox about just how much the Republicans in the House and Senate are being influenced by Wall Street and by the business community, because certainly they have been, many of them, unhappy. When we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about what looks like a deal to reopen the government and to at least temporarily avoid the default. The government would be funded through January 15th, and the debt limit would be raised through February 7th. We have Bruce Kane with us from Stanford and Jim Wilcox, who's in D.C., who is professor in the Haas School of Business. And right now we're getting reports that breaking news is that, talk about one man controlling, Ted Cruz will not block the Senate deal. We'll find out. We'll actually have more of that in just a moment. But I wanted to go to Jim Wilcox, as I had said before the break. And by the way, you can join this conversation, you, our listeners, by going to our website, kqed.org, or tweeting us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum, or emailing us, forum at kqed.org. Jim Wilcox, you know, there's a real schism, obviously, within the Republican Party, and I'm wondering to what extent this has been moved forward and is continuing to move forward because of, well, Chamber of Commerce, Wall Street, business, which is not lining up with the Tea Party.
Well, I think that's right. I think, as you were suggesting, that Wall Street and the business sector does have some considerable influence on Congress, but they're not the only ones, of course. So do organizations like AARP or the medical establishment and defense contractors and lots of others. I think the thing that was quite noticeable was how firmly so much of the business sector and the financial sector made it known that they thought that this was a fool's errand that the House Republicans were undertaking. I think they looked around and said, this is going to be terrifically costly to the economy as a whole, and therefore to our businesses and companies, and to our workers as well. And we see relatively little benefit coming from the entire enterprise. And so I think it's perhaps no accident that we saw the most movement in the last week or so when the business sector finally started to really stand up and be counted, because I think that really did get the attention of a lot of the Republicans in Congress.
We said a minute ago that Ted Cruz was at least saying publicly now that, and this is breaking news, that he would not block this deal. He's talking about it in his cut. Let's hear it.
The deal that has been cut provides no relief to the millions of Americans who are hurting because of Obamacare. The deal that has been cut provides no relief to all the young people coming out of school who can't find a job because of Obamacare. It provides no relief to all the single parents who have been forced into part-time work, struggling to feed their kids on 29 hours a week.
Well, there you hear the concerns that Ted Cruz has about this bill, but he has said that he will not block it, apparently. And we wanted to hear a couple other cuts because this whole deal has been essentially brokered by the goings-on and the back and forth between Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. And they, by the way, have not been very friendly of late, but they managed, in spite of that, to work through this. Let's hear first from Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
For today, the relief we hope for is to reopen the government, avoid default, and protect the historic cuts we achieved under the Budget Control Act. This is far less than many of us had hoped for, frankly, but it's far better than what some had sought. Now it's time for Republicans to unite behind other crucial goals.
Well, that's the Republican side from Mitch McConnell, and let's hear a cut from Harry Reid on the Democratic side.
What we've done is sent a message to Americans from every one of our 50 states, but in addition to that, to the citizens of every country in the world, that the United States lives up to its obligations.
Well, those cuts were from moments ago on the Senate floor. Bruce Kane, reaction from you?
You know, it sounds promising. It doesn't sound like they've moved any closer together in terms of what they believe is a permanent resolution. So, I mean, the important thing, I guess, at this point is to make sure that everybody in the world understands that all this theater does eventually come to an end when something like a serious financial meltdown is around the corner. I mean, there are defaults that happen to countries because their underlying fundamentals are weak. And then there are defaults that happen if mistakes are made, which is the one time I believe we went into default. And then there's a default that is kind of a political suicide. And that's the one that has the rest of the world going, what? And at least I think what we've said is, well, we may threaten suicide, and that's just because that's the way we talk to each other, but we're not really going to commit suicide. And that's not the greatest message in the world, but it's better than what we were heading towards.
And let me head towards some more of your calls. And Steve, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This builds on what Bruce Kane was saying about a parliamentary system. You know, I look at the Tea Party and I say, why don't we talk about them really as a party rather than a faction within the Republican Party? And why doesn't Boehner, you know, really distance himself from them to try to do some governing from the center? You look at Willie Brown. He liked being Speaker. He, for ideological and personal reasons, when he lost a majority in 94, he reached across the aisle and found some Republicans he could work with to maintain his own role.
Well, there are Democrats that John Boehner can work with, to be sure. But Bruce Kane, there's been a lot of talk out in the blogosphere and in talk radio and the right-wing factions of talk radio about forming a conservative party.
Yeah, I mean, they could do that, but the history of third parties in America is not promising, and the people that really know the score in terms of political operatives understand that. So in the American system, you have more leverage inside the tent than outside the tent. So my guess is they'll stay there. They may. What they found is that because primaries and caucuses and other nomination processes are low turnout events, they can come in, that is the Tea Party and its supporters can come in and mobilize their people. And even though they're not a majority of the Republican Party, with money, they can capture some of the nomination processes. So what's gone on here is really a clever manipulation of the way the primary system operates. And to be honest, the establishment Republicans have to come up with a counter strategy of how to identify those vulnerabilities and make sure that they mobilize the Republican voters and the money to go to the areas that the Tea Party is going to strategically target.
Again, Bruce Kane, professor of political science at Stanford, is also director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West. And let me read some of your emails. Jim writes, I was hoping the issue would remain unresolved, allowing the president to invoke the 14th Amendment, setting a precedent to leave the very idea of debt ceiling behind forever. Ted writes, the cumulative damage done by those who say government is the problem is enormous. So much needs to be undone. So many years of damage. Unfortunately, we are negotiating yet another set of confessions to the anti-government propagandists. For example, the sequester remains. Basic research is hobbled. Programs that address the tragedy of lead poisoning remain defunded, and so on. And Chris writes, my problem with the possible deal reach is that we will be facing a government shutdown in 3 months and a default in four. Obama has 3 years left, and is this how it is going to be, a crisis every 3 months? Of course, that's what the Republicans want, but I believe these deals must have a one-year minimum to allow for other issues to come to the fore. That's, I think, a worthy point, Bruce Kane, no?
It is. All these are worthy points. And, you know, in an ideal world, we wouldn't have such poor choices ahead of us. But, I mean, again, no political system, there's no perfect political system in the world that can deal with the very hard situation of when you have completely divergent views about what government should be doing. And it's not just a two-way split, it's a multi-way split. I mean, you have the Tea Party people who I think are libertarian, who really do question whether we need government at all. But then you have establishment Republicans who are every bit as much pro-government as the Democrats. It's just they only believe in certain sections of the government, you know, law enforcement, security, the military, et cetera. And then you have Democrats who believe, you know, that the government does have a purpose, and people that go all the way to the left and have government doing more things. So it is a more ideological time. It is, and any time you have those kind of ideological splits, a political system is going to be under stress, and that's basically what's going on.
And Matt is joining us next. Matt, welcome. You're on the air on Forum.
Thank you. I am a government worker, and I'm curious if it all goes smoothly from here, when will I get to go back to work?
Good question.
And my second question is, does this fiddling around or these threats drive up the interest rate on government bonds in general?
Could I just ask you, Matt, what the impact of the furlough will be on your work and what you do?
Well, I'm a lawyer in the bankruptcy system, and some of my cases that I won right before we went on furlough have been appealed, and I should be in the office writing briefs to counter those appeals to protect the win. But I'm not there, and I don't believe anybody's doing it. So it'll be quite a rush, assuming we get back tomorrow.
Well, he's asking for a little crystal ball here, but Jim Wilcox, talk about the effect this is having on federal workers, can you?
Well, the cuts have and the shutdown have been costly to identifiable group of individuals, federal workers in particular, and also some of the businesses that supply goods and services of all kinds to the federal government. So, in fact, it has been disruptive to them. But it's more than that. It's also been disruptive to consumer sentiment. In general, consumers don't like uncertainty. And, of course, one of the great fears was that the uncertainty that's been bred by this whole series of events is going to actually cause consumers and businesses to be much more cautious in their spending, much more cautious in their hiring plans or longer-term investments. So it can certainly hurt workers, but it can also hurt all the rest of us as well.
Well, in fact, if this went on, it's not over yet, we would certainly be in a recession, wouldn't we?
Well, it would certainly slow down whatever meager growth we've been having for the last few years. Whether you would tip formally into a recession or not, it's really hard to say. But it has to be a drag on the economy. And this is an economy that needs no drags at all. There's too many of them already. And I think this is just continuing to be a drag. One of the problems, I think, with the current solution is that after all is said and done, it doesn't seem to have done very much of anything except extend the problem. I mean, for people that object to kicking the can down the road, this can't be a very good deal. It's better than having the can get crushed, I suppose, but nonetheless, as one of your callers has suggested, in a few months we could be back in a pretty similar situation. And for anybody who has been worried or apprehensive about what might happen under a default scenario or another government shutdown and so on and so forth, they may well continue to be cautious and to be conservative in their spending and in their hiring and investment plans. So we could have continuing effects on the economy as a whole, even if something gets inked today.
Well, I asked you before about the global economy, and here's a listener who writes on our website, one cannot talk about default and not talk about the potential global implications for the U.S., China, and the world. Perpetual dysfunction and playing with the stability, the very foundation of the U.S. government and the world economy, is not something other countries are going to put up with forever. If China is perceived to be a more stable host for the global economy and the yuan, thus a more viable currency, the U.S. could be permanently weakened, and then the rise of China and its communist capitalist system would be assured. Of course, none of this is assured, but it's made significantly more likely. And why risk finding out? Jim Wilcox?
Well, it could well hurt the U.S. reputation in world markets, that's for sure. I think it is an encouraging sign that when Congress really started to look down and be staring at a U.S. government bond default, they blinked. And it's a darn good thing that they blinked. They should have blinked. And I think that'll be reassuring to the world's bond markets. Nonetheless, the specter is now out there that we'll be having similar circumstances and conversations a few months from now. So far, the world's investors have not run pell-mell away from holding U.S. treasuries. There's been a little bit of action at the very, very short end. But in general, we still, despite all the bad publicity and bad outcomes, we still are able to borrow as a nation at remarkably low interest rates all over the world.
Let me just read a couple of your tweets here from different perspectives. One listener tweets, GOP shut down government and threatened default, got nothing. It was important that they get nothing because it threatened governance norms. And Frank tweets, this deal is infuriating. Democrats concede to hostage tactics yet again and set us up for the same nonsense in a few months. A couple of your emails, Stanley writes, one thing that has always bothered me is that political parties, which are not part of the constitutional structure of our government, somehow have complete control over how it functions. This always seems to be hijacking the democratic, or perhaps more accurately, representative republic that the founders intended this country to have. How can we make the system actually represent the people rather than the party? Bruce Kane?
Well, there is a tough one right there. To start with, of course, almost every democracy that we know of has, a contested party system. And the reason is that the
demands of an election require that there are coalitions, that people find the resources and field common positions in order to do something when they get into government that's coordinated. So it's pretty hard to have a democracy that functions without parties. And if we didn't have parties, we'd have just factions, and the factions would then form coalitions, and it would sure look like a party. So I don't think you can do without that. I don't think the answer is going to be getting rid of parties. The answer, if we really wanted to do something about this, there are more technical changes we could make. You know, for example, we had the same problem in California, and we passed Proposition 25 in 2010. And what that did was it aligned the incentives of the legislators with the incentives of the rest of us by taking away their salary and not giving it back retroactively for every day they went past the deadline. And so far, it's worked. We've been meeting all our deadlines. And it's one of the problems here is the congressional salaries are exempt. In fact, the Senate staff wasn't really facing any kind of loss of income until today. I wonder whether that had something to do with it. So I think, you know, there are some simple things we could do like that, and possibly, you know, moving to biennial budgets such that they do the budget, they pass the budget in the just before an election, so they're aware that these things could possibly affect their November election. That also might move it. But I don't think we can do anything more drastic. We can't get rid of divided government. We can't get rid of the party system. It's going to have to be more technical twists on the system.
And let me bring more of your calls in. We go next to John in San Mateo. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. You talked earlier about the unlikelihood of a party coming out of the Republican Party, sort of the conservative side. What about, is it possible that some Republicans, moderates, are now finding that, you know, the Republican Party is not really very friendly to them? They might actually start switching over to the Democratic Party.
Seems unlikely, doesn't it, Bruce Kane?
Yeah,
in fact, there aren't that many moderate Republicans to begin with. They're centrists as opposed to Tea Party people, but I wouldn't call them in the old Nelson Rockefeller or Jacob Javits style moderate Republicans.
Right. I mean, there are a handful of them, and you know, like in the Senate with Snow. But the North. One of the great ironies is that when we had the elections in 2006 and 2008, and the Democrats took control, the people that got wiped out were the moderates. And so, ironically, what happens is what's left in the party are the conservative diehards. Now, some of them are in marginal seats. And so, for example, everybody talks about the Pennsylvania gerrymander that produced a large Republican majority in a state that's considered more or less leaning Democrat. Well, if you look carefully at that, you'll see that a number of those seats, even though they don't have a lot of moderates in them, are extremely marginal. And so it's quite possible that they're going to have, even if they survive their nominations by being true blue, they're going to have trouble when they get into the general election. So, you know, it may be that a party has to go through these crises of ideology. Democratic parties to some degree did that too, and that was what Clinton and Feinstein did, was pull the party out of its ideological base. You hope that there's going to be a correction down the road for the Republicans as well, that they realize that this, and the only way they're going to learn that is if they really do lose control of the House as well. Then I think you will start to see a reorganization of the party and a reaffirmation of the establishment Republicans over the Tea Party.
Let me thank John for his call. It goes without saying that the Republicans have been hurt more by this impasse than the Democrats. But Jim Wilcox, a question from a listener named Mary who says, where's the Koch money in all this? Do they fund Heritage as well as Cato? And it's a good question because there is a lot of Koch money.
Well, that could be. I don't really know whom the Koch brothers are funding. They have the wherewithal to provide a lot of funds to a lot of people, I suspect. But we have people on all sides of these issues that are receiving funds from various kinds of interests, special interests of our own and the ones we don't like as well. So it may well be that they've been more influential than a lot of other organizations, but there's plenty to go around, as it turns out.
Well, there have been so many snafus and mess-ups in this website that the Affordable Health Care Act, or Obamacare, has set up for people, citizens, that if perhaps they had just left it alone, it would have been better in the long run. Because, as I said earlier, that if anybody suffered as a result of this, it's the GOP. Let me get another caller on here. And Bill, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on.
Yeah. I was wondering how many people are actually in the Tea Party. Ted Cruz claims that millions and millions of Americans are rallying against Obamacare.
Well, you know, that's a good question, particularly in light of what the polls show. Bruce Kane, if they say to them, do you like Obamacare, it comes out very differently than if they ask about what's in Obamacare.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that the Tea Party is not a majority of America for certain. They're not, in most states, a majority of the Republican Party. In some states, it can be as high as 30% or 40%, but in most states, it's more like a fifth or 30% of the party would of the Republicans would identify themselves as Tea Party people. So it's definitely a minority faction. And as I said, they've leveraged their power through the clever use of the nomination process and influencing people in the primaries, because they're not going to have the leverage in a general election. By the time you get to the general election, people are more concerned about defeating the Democrat. But their successes to date have been largely in the primaries, and that's having a lot of people now are starting to question whether the primaries, which were brought in as a Democratic innovation, really are serving the purpose that they were supposed to serve, or whether they're just basically serving as vehicles for the people with intense ideological preferences.
But because of gerrymandering, they're all pretty safe in their districts, aren't they?
Well, now, we've been through this before. Yes, on the margin, partisan gerrymandering or gerrymandering by incumbents does contribute to the problem, but the problem is much deeper than that, and that is that there's a fair amount of evidence of what we call party sorting and geographical sorting. Party sorting means that starting in 1965, the cross coalitions between Southern conservative Democrats and liberals broke down. And so what happened was the social conservatives migrated over to be with the economic conservatives, and the South turned Republican. So that's called party sorting. And then the other thing we have is geographical sorting, namely, how many Republicans are living in San Francisco right now? How many Republicans are there in the Bay Area? How many Democrats are they in the southern part of Orange County? You know, we basically have created homogeneous splotches across America, and that is manifests itself when you have geographical districting.
And we'll get another caller on from San Diego. Scott, you're on. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, you know, I'm a Democrat, and I was kind of actually leaning toward the GOP a few times over the last few years, and now I'm totally ready to stay a solid Democrat, and I'm wondering how this might affect midterm elections if people are going to say, you know, we need to give the House a clear majority so that we can have or can avoid these problems in the future. Obviously, we wouldn't have this if the Democrats controlled the House, and I think the GOP, they've really alienated a lot of people that might have been considering or maybe on the fence about which party to be with. I'm just curious what your view is on
that. Yeah, let me again go to you on this, Bruce Kane. I mean, can you take the pulse of the midterm elections at this juncture?
Well, this is part of what's going on here. The Republicans have gone back and analyzed the effects of the shutdown crisis in the 90s, and they argue that public memories are short, and that, in fact, they didn't pay a big price for the shutdown, as the common wisdom suggests. So they're banking on the fact that people's memories are short, and that by the time you get around to the election, they will have forgotten about this, or they'll be focused on some other issue. Now, the fact that you're going to have to do this again in January and February suggests to me that that theory isn't going to work very well, and that once again will be the obstruction tactics will be front and center. So I actually think it might, and as I said, I've looked at Pennsylvania, which is where they're going to be most vulnerable, or where the redistricting was a partisan redistricting, because when you do that, you shave the margins of incumbents in order to spread the wealth, and when you do that, you open yourself up to wave elections. And so I think the places like Colorado, Pennsylvania, and Texas where they did that, that's where you're going to see the battleground for control of the House. And I think if this image that they have now stays for another year or is reinforced for another year, then I think you could see a transformation of the House and the Democrats could be back in control of all three branches.
And since we had a question earlier about the Koch brothers, according to the New York Times and other sources, the Koch brothers have long worked against the health law and have contributed to organizations like Heritage Action for America that are pressing lawmakers to end financing for it. And some of you may remember we had Chris Matthews on, and he was talking about how this appeared originally in the New York Times, how Jim DeMint, now of Heritage, and the Koch brothers and former Nixon Attorney General Ed Meese had all worked together to plan this initial strategy that has, well, at least backfired for now, it would appear. But we will continue to stay on top of this. I just want to read, since we also spoke about Rush Limbaugh and his influence, read an email from Valerie who says, I think we need to address the basic part of the problem we are experiencing. What if we reinstated the fairness doctrine? It would change the tone of the current hate speech on our airways. I believe this would reset some of this current tone of all of our conversations. Well, this has certainly been a good and enlightening conversation. I want to extend special thanks to Bruce Cain, who is with us this whole hour, professor of political science at Stanford and now director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West. And thank you, Bruce, for being with us. Enjoy having you and always get enlightened by you.
Thanks.
Thanks to Jim Wilcox, also, who is a professor in the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, joined us from the nation's capital. And ditto for you, Jim Wilcox. Good to have had you with us on Forum. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we didn't get enough Elisa Mascaro because things were happening as we spoke, but we will continue to obviously follow this story and keep you as up to date as we can. We also have another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to talk with novelist, memoirist, and author Danny Shapiro, who has a book out called Still Writing, and it's all about the pleasures and perils of writing. And she gives us kind of her perspective after over 20 years of teaching writing and writing herself. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We always welcome thoughts from you about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website. You can continue this conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.